Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest is one of the giants in our profession, a guy for whom I have a great deal of respect, University of Illinois head coach Mike Small. Mike's record over the past 24 years has been mind-boggling. His teams have made match play in 8 of the past 12 seasons. Illinois has won 13 of the last 14 Big Ten championships. He's coached 2 NCAA individual champions, along with 16 players who've been named All-American on 33 occasions. He's accomplished all of this and much more while still playing competitive golf. He's arguably the best playing college golf coach of all time. Please join me in listening to his philosophies, which have produced some incredible results for over 2 decades. All right, Better Than I Found It listeners, let's welcome one of my very good friends in the coaching profession, Illinois men's golf coach Mike Small, to the podcast today. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Well, it's a pleasure, Michael, and tons of respect for you. Our friendship has grown over the years, and I admire everything you do, so this is a fun time for me as well.
Well, this is great for both of us. You know, before we get into the coaching aspect of it and kind of finding out a little bit more about that, let's just wrap up the fall. My listeners have already kind of gotten a wrap up of our fall. How about the fall for the Fighting Illini?
I thought it was a successful fall. You know, I think all falls from a coaching perspective are successful because I think that's where you learn a lot about your team. And I think a lot of coaches go about it differently, how to approach a fall. But I think you learn a lot. You put your guys, at least I put our guys in situations this year on campus and away at tournaments that showed where their games are, built confidence in where their games are, but also exposed issues they need to get better at. And so I think that's success in its own right. And then obviously when it comes down to the wins and losses, we won a really big tournament at Sahali at the start of the fall with a young team, not knowing what I was going to get or what we were going to expect to have. And then we kind of played average the rest of the year. Didn't play as well as we did at Sahali. I think maybe we started thinking too much. But at the same point, like I said a minute ago, we learned a lot about ourselves. We played some tournaments where we created some adversity through the schedule and some expectations. Then now we learned how to handle a little better. I think success leading into the spring, I think we're in a good position. I think we're ranked, 16th in the coaches poll and 20th in Spike Mark or Clipped or whatever it is these days. We're in the game. We're young. I have 5 new players of 9 on my squad. So I have more first year players than I have returners. So all things being considered, I thought it was a successful fall.
I love hearing that because that's one of the things coaches place too much emphasis on, the actual result, when sometimes it's what learning is taking place. It's really going to yield all the results later in the spring. So that's good.
That's right.
You know, you mentioned, you didn't mention the Fighting Illini. Unfortunately, it was the first time ever that the final round got rained out. I've been going to that tournament since you started it. I love it. Disappointed that it was rained out. I know every team that wanted to climb the leaderboard felt the same. But I look back on your early career, and you were having a lot of success and doing great and winning some Big Ten championships. But I look at the Fighting Illini back in 2008. I had a really good team at Oklahoma State. We were really good, and we were leading after 36 holes, paired with you in Indiana in the final round. And I look at that, when I look back on it, as sort of a turning point, because I think it was the first time you guys ever believed that you could win against any team in the country. And you talk about that, if you would. I remember that day very well.
Yeah, you had a great team. I think you won the stroke by Porsche of the NCAAs that year, didn't you?
We did.
At Inverness, I think. And yep. That was the first year match play was put into play, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, so this was the fall before that. And we had some good players. I had 2 PGA Tour players on that team with Scott Langley and Luke Guthrie. And then I had Chris DeForest, who was a very talented player from New York. And then we had 2 juniors on that team, Zach Barlow and Matt Hoffman. So not a lot of proven players yet as of that time, but there was some potential and some talent there. And I think that you're right. That was probably the first big national event that we had won as a program. We had won some other events and some good solid college events, but to win on that stage, I think showed our guys a lot, built a lot of momentum. I think we went on to win 7 times that year and went to the national finals. And yeah, it was a moment where I think the guys believed that they could play. I mean, I think Ricky Fowler was there, and
It was.
Brooks Koepka played there. Thinking back on those days, and but you had a great team, and I think Zach Barlow won that event too, which was a
He
big
did.
coming out party for him. And here's a young man who came to Illinois and couldn't make the lineup his first year or two, was way out of his league, self-admittedly now, if he looks back at it. But he worked hard and met the challenges and met the intensity of the program, and ended up being a runner-up in the Western Amateur, I think, later that next summer. So to go where he came from, to go to win that event, and to have that amateur career, I think was a big eye-opener for our program as well. And but all programs and all individuals in golf, all players, when they first have a dose of success at a level they've always aspired to, but they haven't accomplished, I think that's a big confidence booster. And team golf and individual golf, obviously a lot of parallels there, parallels. But yeah, it's something that I think we look back and it jumped us to what we've started, a pretty good 15-year run.
Yeah, I would say it's a great run. In fact, I'm not going to give all of the accomplishments, but if you'll indulge me, I'm going to go over just a few of the highlights. You've been coaching 24 seasons in your 24th. You've won 13 out of the last 14 Big Ten titles, including, I think, 8 in a row. You won 5 regional titles. In the last 12 years, your team has been in the top 5 at nationals 8 times, runner up in 2013, 3 straight years made the semifinals. Last year, just last year, so that the success is not slowing down. You were ranked number 1 in golf stat at the end of the year, 172, 9-3 head-to-head record, 7 wins, 2 first-team All-Americans. I mean, it's been quite a run. Plus, you've had 2 individual NCAA champions and 16 different players have won 33 All-American awards. Mike, come on. What a stretch.
Yeah, and you're right. It started about that Olympia Fields year, 2008, and we were trying to find ourselves for a few years before that. But you look back at that run, and what it's consistency, which we always talk about in our program. I think all good golfers and people in life, I think, should be judged more on their consistency than maybe a flash in the pan or having a good year there. I think we all want to have great years, don't get me wrong, but I think consistency says a lot about your culture and a lot about what you do. And if you look back at the 15 years, you had the one COVID year, which we didn't play. And then besides those years, we've been to the national championship every year but one. And the one year we didn't make it to the finals, we were still a top 20 team. So it's not like we tanked. And the one year we didn't win the Big Ten championship in the last 15 years, we were still ranked 5th in the country. And we made it to the match play again that year. We got beat by a Minnesota team with some really strong seniors and a good team. And they beat us at the Big Tens that year. But besides that, we were still ranked 5th in the country. So even those streaks we've had of making the national finals and winning Big Ten championships, there's been one blip in all that 15 years. We still had good teams those years. And that's something I'm proud of. I'm proud of for the kids that they take those expectations and embrace them every year. But we also know that all this stuff's going to come to an end sometime. It's not going to go on forever. And I think that's what motivates us as coaches and players, is to not let that happen or not get that to, not to have that come about. But we also understand that it is life, and you have to take the good with the bad, and it's going to happen. So, we're just very blessed and grateful, and for the support that we've gotten here at the university and from administration, our supporters and donors. And I'm blessed to have our kids back all that support up with hard work and effort. And that's kind of what they've done. And those accomplishments you read off, I don't think is probably enough about them as I should. And but it's something that I'm very proud of.
Well, you should be. It's been a great run, and I know it's not over. But you mentioned consistency, and so I don't think a team from the Midwest has ever had a stretch like this. I know Ohio State was good for a long time. Herb Page did a great job at Kent State consistently through the years, but this has got to be the greatest stretch of a Midwest team. You've never made weather an excuse. I've never heard you say it. In fact, you probably think it's a strength, which is great. But how do your guys work in the winter as opposed to later in the spring? I mean, how do you guys maintain that during the winter? Because you do have challenging winters compared to a guy in Arizona or Southern California.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for that. And This streak, like we talked about, the stretch has been, I think, unprecedented. I think our SID did some work on that, and that's again, I'm very grateful for what everybody puts into this thing, but it does come down to self-belief. It comes down to keeping yourself accountable to the players, to what they have to do to get better, and to play to a certain level, to embrace that level. And then when you talk about getting better in the winter, I mean, I think programs. I like to see our team improve all year, even though we're accumulating wins, we're accumulating head-to-head wins in our rankings and getting ready for the postseason, because that's what we play. I mean, as you, we're here to represent the university and have great NCAA finishes and Big Ten finishes. But we're here, I believe, to get these guys better and to help develop them and help them grow as not only people, first and foremost, but players. And you do it all year long. And even though we have subpar weather from probably November 15th to March 1st, we don't get as bad a weather as Chicago gets because we don't have all that lake effect snow, and we just get it's cold. You can't play golf, but you still need to get better. And we've built some unbelievable facilities that fit the way I think the game should be taught and the way the game should be played, and it supports our personality of our program. And so we combine technical growth in the winter with the facilities, the bays, the huge indoor chipping and pitching area, which is Scott Langley and Thomas Peters. You mentioned those guys earlier as two individual national champions. They say the indoor practice short game area built them as players. When you combine the facilities and the way they're designed with the culture of the program and the competitiveness that we try to grow through bringing a grit and grind every day and an accountability factor to our practices, I think that promotes growth, and it builds growth, and it shows it. So the kids first put the time in. They're a facility and a culture and around each other where they want to be. They're excited to be practicing all winter long. They can't get out and play, so they're landlocked, if you will, or weatherlocked, where they can't be teased to go out and play as much while they're on campus. So they're made and forced to address areas of their game. And like I said, in a competitive, accountable fashion, and it's worked out great for us. And our guys do get better. And I think the culture's a part of that, but it's them. And I'm the first one to say that it is their game, it's their accomplishments, it's not ours, it's not our programs as much, even though we get labeled as we have today as being the house for all of that. But they get better. And I think when you put purpose with talent, and they grow. They grow as people and players, and that's kind of what we've done for 15 years. And it's just kind of grown on itself. And again, it's not guaranteed. Our guys on the team this year know firsthand that this is not guaranteed that they're going to win another Big Ten or they're going to make it to the match play again for all these times. There's no guarantee, so they have to put the work in. They have to confront their deficiencies and improve.
I love that. You speak of the competitive grit, all of that. I mean, that's who I see in you when I watch you coach and when I watch you, just through the years when I've seen you. But you came by that honestly. I mean, your dad played basketball at Illinois and he played on a Big Ten championship team. Your brother played baseball at Illinois on a Big Ten championship team, and you played golf there on a Big Ten championship team. What was it like growing up in a family with so many competitive genes?
Well, we all played all sports,
Yeah.
and we just gravitated to those. I mean, obviously, my dad was a very good basketball player. Got drafted by the Pistons, and didn't play in the NBA, but got drafted. Back then, I think there were eight teams in the NBA, and his contract was for less than $8,000 a year back in the early '60s. So it was a different way of life. But he had a successful Big Ten career or basketball career, and then my brother and I played other sports, and we just were just loved. Loved the joy of it, the competing and just all the uncertainty of it maybe, and not knowing if you're going to win or lose, and seeing if you can circumvent and navigate your way through adversity or troubles and try to come out on top. And we did it in all these different sports, and to come to Illinois, we weren't pigeonholed here at all. We had other opportunities, but it just made sense. I mean, Illinois is a great place. It's middle America. It's a big time institution, big time academics, athletics. And it was something that we did have a legacy here, and it's something that we're proud we did. And it's kind of over the years, we've been maybe recognized obviously here in the Midwest and in Illinois for all that stuff. And it's kind of a neat little sidebar to our family, but we just do things we enjoy doing. And I think athletics is the main point there. And my wife, she's a graduate and she was in music, and my son was in the marching line, I hear, as a musician. So different avenues, but they all kind of gravitate towards following your desires and being at a place you love.
That's incredible. You know, that 88 team, you had some really good, obviously, teammates, and you guys won the title. But one of your teammates, Steve Stricker, who's become, I think, one of the most respected players in the last 25 or 30 years in the world by players, more than anything, by players, he's been respected. So how has he reached out to your team? Have you used him in any way to kind of help inspire your players through the years?
Well, Michael, I agree with that. Strick is he's a professional. He's a pro. He's a wonderful human being. And I would never have played the PGA Tour back before I started coaching if it wasn't for Steve Stricker. And I use that a lot in my recruiting and coaching today. You know, I didn't know what good golf was when I came to Illinois as a junior golfer. And when I played with Steve for 3 years, I saw what good golf was, and he made me better. So being around good players and being around a good culture and knowing what it takes to get somewhere is huge. And then obviously when Steve went on to play the PGA Tour and had a lot of, he's won 12 times, and you know, he's had more or less two different careers. But people realize, you know, he came out of college and it took him, I think, 5 years to get his PGA Tour card. It took me seven. It took him five. And then he went on to win a couple times and went to top 10 in the world. And then he lost his game. He lost his driver and didn't play well and fell off the tour and went back, had to go back to second stage of tour school, and had about 3 or 4 years there where it was really bleak. But he found it in the dirt. He found it in his game. He went to all his teachers around the country and couldn't, did nothing clicked. And he decided to do it himself. And to a testament to his grit and his hard work and his talent, he fought back and won 10 more times, I think, in his 40s, and went to number two in the world. I mean, if that's not inspiration to a team and a program, I don't know what is, to come back from that. And we're friends to this day. We don't probably talk as much as we did just a couple of years ago because of his daughters are growing and traveling, and he's playing so much more than he ever did. And the Ryder Cup captaincy was a big part of his life, but Strick's a big part of mine. And you know, we still communicate, still keep in touch, but we're so proud of him. And you know, just what he's done. And then to your point, he's when I first started coaching, he was playing on the PGA Tour, and that's when he kind of going through that little rut that he had. But he was still here to help us, support us, and help us raise money and be a part of the program. And he's given his time in support of me of building this thing for the last 20 some years. That's been invaluable. And you know, we owe so much to Strick, and he's definitely an Illini great.
Well, you know, I'm obviously not close and attached to the program, but I've been a huge Stricker fan forever. And his ability to overcome that like dark valley that he went into and become one of the best players in the world was absolutely outstanding. So I'm glad he's inspired your players. Speaking of players, recruiting, we all know that's the absolute lifeblood of a golf program. If you don't recruit well, you're probably not going to have a great program. Now you need to develop those players that you do get, but still you need to recruit. How have you done, and I think you do the best job of it, or one of the best jobs in college golf, of finding players that fit your personality and your coaching style? I'm not talking about just a little kid you plug in, you know, into a system. I'm talking about that values that culture you talk about, you know, that you've been talking about, that grit. You know, a perfect example to me is Nick Hardy. I've watched him since he was a junior golfer, and all the way through to his professional career. He looks like the perfect Mike Small guy, like a guy you could get in there and get in his grill and he had no problem with it. How do you, in the vetting out process, how do you find these kids that work for you?
Well, people have said that. Guys on my team have always said Nick Hardy is my child from a different father, but or yeah, he's and I think he takes that as a compliment, and I do too. But I've had a lot of Nick Hardys, a lot of guys that buy in. And when you're recruiting players, you try to find people that fit your system. I think all coaches should do that. I think if you just go off the rankings or go off somebody that compresses it without getting to know who they are, I think you're making a mistake. And so a lot of the players on this program have come in with the personality we need, but a lot of the great players have come in not knowing they had that personality, not knowing that they had it in them to take their intensity and their focus and their grit and their drive to another level. But I think a lot of them have graduated with that understanding of the game, and that the game is not just a pastime or a hobby. It's a competitive sport, and you have to address it and respect it in that way. And you know, you can talk about guys like, I mean, Peters and Thomas Peters and Scott Langley and Luke Guthrie, who we already talked about, but maybe, you know, guys like Thomas Dietrich and Tommy Cool, who just graduated last year, and Michael Feagles. These guys were all Americans just recently, but I think they learned how to take the game to another level. And then you have guys like, that comes to mind, Alex Burge, who played for us for a couple of years. The year we finished runner up to Alabama, he was on our top five. And the next 2 years, he didn't play for us because Nick Hardy and Dylan Meyer come in, and they're all Americans. They end up being first team all Americans, beat him out. But the drive and the discipline and the grit that he had still had on the team, and the leadership that he showed, helped us go on to, you know, a couple more Final Fours and being ranked number one in the country, I think. So, you know, I think you find the person, you find the people that you get along with that appreciate you for who you are as a coach, and appreciate maybe the honesty that you deliver to them when you meet them, and vice versa. And then I respect what they, you know, they're open themselves up to changing. A lot of kids, when they come to college, think they're really good, and they may be good as juniors, but they're never as good as they need to be. I mean, no junior's ever really as good as they need to be at that point, in my opinion. I think everybody has room to grow. But when these kids, come and they want to be a part of it, and they want to jump in, and they want to dive in, and they understand that there is growth. You know, those are the kids that I get excited about, the kids that want to be here. And, you know, Thomas Dietrich comes to mind. Thomas Dietrich is what, top 60 in the world right now in professional golf. He's made millions. He's on the PGA Tour, and he's on the European Tour. And he came in very polished, very good young player. And he had a competitive edge into him that he had never really understood how to chisel, how to make it work for him. And he left here as, boy, one of the best players we ever coached. And he's going to be on the PGA Tour for a long, long time. And but he had it in him and didn't know it. And I think that's what coaches have to do, is they have to identify players that may not, that obviously fit their program now, but maybe have the ability and have the desire to fit their program eventually and then mold to it.
You know, wow. I'd never heard it put that way. I love it. I think that's fantastic. And, you know, I try to find a certain player, but you've given me a different insight as to how I could actually develop and bring that out of players more often. You know, one of the things you and I fight, every coach fights, and it's just part of our world today, but that is entitlement. And I know you are the absolute opposite of entitlement. You go out and earn something every day. I feel the same way. Would you agree with that? Entitlement's a danger?
Yes, I think it's a progression of our country and success we've had. I mean, when people think they accomplished something on the backs of others before them, that's the definition of entitlement. And I think that's, our country has done that over generations. And it's something that I try to let our players know, that become your own man, become your own legacy, you know, and take every day of the opportunity. So you're right. And that's something that we fight, but it comes about from people wanting to help younger people. So it comes out of good faith. It comes out of good intentions, but sometimes a lot of times it comes out adversely in the end.
Well, okay. So that's a perfect segue to a quote from you probably 5, 6, or 7 years ago. I wrote it down. I've got it right here. If you give me a second, I'm going to read it.
Uh-oh.
Here goes. Overactive parenting and too much help and assistance for a junior golfer is not always the answer. Laying themselves as a foundation of self-discipline, owned commitment, and resiliency through adversity is so much bigger as an advantage for junior golfers than catering to their every need or giving them every perceived advantage comparable to their peers. I've never been attracted to spoiled junior golfers who think they are on tour at 16 years old. It's just my old-fashioned belief. I like kids from good families that have talent and a desire to be great, not only for themselves, but for their university as well. You were quoted as saying that. I thought it was incredible. I've used that in the back of my mind ever since. Do you remember saying
I don't remember saying that, but I believe that. So maybe I did say it,
that?
obviously. But I mean, I trust you. I don't know what I was in what context that was, but I mean, I just think people become more positive or more proud of themselves when they problem solve and they get through obstacles and they feel like they all need assistance. Everybody needs assistance. I've needed assistance. You need assistance. We need to be coached. But at the same point in time, when somebody can take that assistance and do it themselves and feel like they were the ones that did it, it does so much for your self-image and for your belief and in happiness. I mean, I think people in the world get happier about themselves when they realize they accomplished something and people didn't do it for them. I think people want to do things for people because they love them and they care about them, which is great. But I think when you look at the person who's actually doing the work, if they really feel like they put the time in, the work in, the effort in, they problem solved, and then they have success. That's happiness. That's joy. That is pride. That's human nature. That man, I got accomplished something, and that's what I try to be a conduit and help these kids. But when I recruit players, I tell them, I said, if you come in here and be an All-American, which we've had lots of first team, I think we had 8 or 9 first team All-Americans, they've done that. Okay, I haven't done it for them. They're not coming here just to a sprinkle pink pixie dust on them and they're going to be great. They have to do it. But at the same point, if they come to school here and they never play and they average 74 and they don't ever get in a tournament, again, I didn't do that either. They have to understand that responsibility starts early and starts now, and that they reap the rewards from all the success they've had. I think that builds a very positive, accomplished human being if they really believe they through help of others, but they, when it came down to crunch time, they had the talent, the skill, the mental and emotional stability to accomplish things. And that's maybe what I meant by that. And the earlier a person can learn that, not too early. I mean, I'm not talking 10 or 12 years old, 13 years old. I mean, those kids are, they're still kids. They still need the guidance of a parent. But I'm talking 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, when a problem happens on the golf course or something goes wrong, I think a good player is a good player if he can problem solve and maybe get himself on track himself through it, through learning and through experience, instead of always running to his teacher for the answer or running to his coach for the answer or his swing teacher or running to his parents for the answer. And the more those people jump in the way before he can fix it out and fix it himself, I think that stunts his growth. So maybe that's where the context of that quote came from.
I love that. It self-reliance. Now I realize we all depend on other people, just like you m mentioned a moment ago, but self-reliance is, there's so much more value in that because you were the one that did it. It's the opposite of entitlement. I don't expect it just because I'm me or just because I'm at Illinois. I used to tell our guys at Oklahoma State, you might be ranked number one in the country, but there's no continuum of success. You've got to go play next week and
That's right.
see. It's every week you earn it.
Well, my
Go ahead.
Michael and I and I also sorry to interrupt you there, but I also tell my guys that just because we want you to be independent and responsible and accountable for your actions doesn't mean you have to be so stubborn that you never can come ask for help either. I think they need to come ask for help, and I think they need to be coached. But I think a successful program, a successful coach knows how much to coach and knows when not to coach. And I think a lot of the best coaching I've ever done, and a lot of coaches I've talked to, is the best thing to do is do nothing a lot of times, is to say nothing. But I think a lot of people want to help so much. And I think coaches and parents, to your point earlier, want to help so much that I think they get in the way and they stop the progression of a young man doing it himself. But I also think you can go too far, like I'm saying, is that some kids think, well, I know I shouldn't ask for help. I should be able to do this myself. No, if you get in a pinch and you got to learn the stuff, I think that's important. So there's a fine line between coaching too much and not enough.
I've been guilty occasionally of coaching too much, and I back off from that when I realize that kid needs to learn it himself. Very good. You do as good a job of what I'm getting ready to speak of as anybody that I've seen in the last 15 or 20 years, and that's understanding the value of confrontation. And everybody has such a negative viewpoint of what confrontation is. They think it's got all these negative feelings or whatever. Confrontation is just clearing the air. It's just you and me, two human beings, understand each other. And here's what I believe. And then what do you think about it? So the value of confrontation, why are you so good at it? And are you good at it? Am I just perceiving that from my point of view? I think you're good at it.
Well, yes, I think that I wouldn't know if I'm good or bad at it. It's just important. It's important to me. And people think confrontation is negative and it's always bullying or boisterous. You know, it's not at all. Confrontation is an open, like you said, an open channel of communication. I tell all my assistant coaches when they work for me that if you're going to be a head coach someday, you cannot be afraid of confrontation. You cannot run away from things. You got to clear the air, and you do it in a respectful manner. You do it in a respectful, courteous manner, but you have to talk things out. And I think when people learn that about you and know that you're coming from a point of strength, because confrontation, you got to come from a point of strength in confrontation. You have to have confidence in yourself that you can have a dialogue and back it up. But it comes from, you know, it just comes, a lot of it comes from respect. I respect this person. I want to clear the air. I want to have them understand how I feel, and I want to understand how they feel. But it's not a negative thing. Now, sometimes with a player, you know, the tempers flare or other coaches and competition, people think of that as confrontation. And maybe that is the true, I don't know what the true definition of it is, but I think you need to confront people, and I think in a positive, respectful manner, but that's how you get better. And I think honesty is where everything starts. Now, you're not rude. You're not, you know, degrading it by any means. You're not even close to that, but you're just being open and honest. And I think that starts like going back in the recruiting process. And some young people and some parents aren't ready for that. The ones that are, we have great dialogue.
Wow. So I agree 100% with what you just said. I learned it at Oakland State working for Mike Holder. And I'm thankful that I had that opportunity to do that because I think I'm better at it now than I've ever been. I can get better. One of the things that I know you do a great job of, because I see it in your players, is handling pressure in tournaments and embracing it and loving it. How do you create that in practice? How do you do it in Champaign when you guys are not on the road?
I think the great ones have it innately in them. They love to compete. They're not afraid to lose. They love to win, but they hate to lose. But I think everybody has it in them to develop that. If you have passion for something and you really want to be good at it, you can be very competitive and you can embrace it. But if you don't have passion for it and you don't really care about it, you know, a lot of people love to play golf just because they love to play the game. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But if you want to be great at the game and you want to compete and you want to be the best and you love it and you just can't get enough of it, you're going to be thrown into that zone and thrown into that ability to compete a lot easier. So you got to have kids that want it, that love to be around it, that hate to lose, but aren't afraid to lose, love to win. And then I think as a coach, you foster that in every aspect of your job and of your relationship with them, knowing that if you win or lose, it's not going to make you a bad person or a unsuccessful person or a failure by any means, because there's always going to be another challenge right around the corner to go and get excited about. But you have to, I tell people, I said, it's kind of weird. I said, true competitors are really only happy if they're really chasing something, if there's really something they're really chasing and going after. And if that's the case, I think you got something. And the way we do that is you bring it, you know, they have their core belief, but then if they can have little challenges or little competitions in everything they do, I think that just builds that ability to compete. So, you know, we have little, you know, we have competitions, we have qualifying, obviously during the season, and we have you know, big break themed things where we do competition, and inside we'll do little one-on-one Ryder Cup matches and team Ryder Cup matches, and we'll do speed matches, and we'll just, you know, you have to learn to embrace the challenge of not knowing what's next, but being okay with the outcome, maybe not liking it, but understanding it and just putting it on the line. And The whole point of this stuff is to thrust you into the zone so that you can compete at the highest level you can without consciously trying to do it. And it's still hard for me as a competitor and a coach to do it sometimes. So the young kids have to have a really hard time to really being thrown into that zone. And if you love the arena of competing and the thrill of possibly losing versus winning and not knowing what's next, then I think you can, then you're really in the realm of being a competitor.
Very good, very good. So what's the best piece of advice you've ever received from another coach? It could be a basketball coach, it could be any kind of coach, but great coaching advice from another coach.
Oh man. I mentioned it a little bit earlier. My dad always told me, he says, you got to learn to take the good with the bad. My dad coached junior college basketball as a side job when I was younger. I was always, I'd always be over intense and always think everything had to be great. Sometimes you got to take the good with the bad. You always have to take the good with the bad. So there's going to be bad days. There's going to be losses. And so you have to take them. You have to accept them and move on for them and not always think it's always, you're always going to win. When I first got here at Illinois, I just come off the tour playing and I've been around sports my whole life, but I never coached. And so I always had, I was surrounded by a lot of great coaches here at the university that I really tapped into and talked to. And I guess the Hall of Fame's track coach's office is right next to mine, Gary Winicky, won many, many national and Big Ten championships. This guy was a legend. And he said, when you're trying to build a culture, you're trying to come in every team every year. He said, remember, as a head coach, you can always, it's always better to get easier on them throughout the year than it is to get harder. If that makes sense. So you don't come in and you're not buddy buddy, and then all of a sudden they lose a few games, and I shouldn't say buddy buddy, but just soft and just happy and everything's great, and there's no accountability, I guess, is what he was saying. And then you lose a few games, and all of a sudden you got to get upset and get mad and try to recalibrate them and get them focused. I think you get them focused and you get them done, that you get them on that mindset early, and then you can always loosen up later. And that's a good recipe for success, I think, is it when you come down championship season, you want to relax and trust all the work you've put into it and then have fun. Or you come to tournaments, you come to have fun. The work is done back on campus. Kind of what he was saying is that then you get there at the start of the fall or start of the season, you set the tone, you set what you want to do. And then you can build that threshold or build that level you want to, that intensity, that focus you want to play at. And then you can always lighten up it later. But you can't reverse it. And I think that made a lot of sense. And I think that has a lot to do with our scheduling. I mean, when I first got to Illinois, I saw all the tournaments in Puerto Rico and I saw all these events in Mexico and Hawaii. I'm like, man, those are fun. So we'll go to those. That's gotta be great for recruiting. And then you go down there and all of a sudden, one or two events into the spring, you're on vacation, you're sitting down there going to the beach, and all of a sudden, what are you really getting accomplished? And I think about 15, 20 years ago, whatever it was, I said, I'm gonna go to some events where the weather's not going to be great, where the conditions are going to be a little bit tougher, maybe events where we have everything to lose and nothing to win. So you had to be ready to play in February. You go there early, you set the tone for your team, and then you go to the nice places the next 2 or 3, 4 weeks once you've established the tone where you want to be. I think that's been a big part of our success too. You're not always playing catch up in the spring. I think you set the tone early. So I think that goes back to what Gary told me.
Very good. Very good. Speaking of coaches, you've always done a good job of getting good young assistant coaches. Really good job of that. And you've got a great one right now, I think, Ruben. What you've only had him for a semester. I realize that, but what are some of his good qualities that are going to make him a good head coach one day?
Well, Ruben's a good person, by the way. He's a smart young man. And I mean, now with NCAA rules, we have two assistant coaches. So I have Eric Gilpin as well, as we just promoted him to our second assistant. So I have two of them for the first time. So it's kind of fun mentoring and being around those guys and helping them. Ruben has come to us from Iowa State, and I guess unlike my other assistants, he has a little more experience than the other ones have had. I've gotten assistant coaches before that had very little coaching experience or were very young and green. I think Ruben, to his self admitted, still he came here because he has a lot to learn and wants to be a head coach someday. But he came in working for Andrew Tank at Iowa State, and Andrew did a good job with him and mentored him. So he's been coaching for a while, not a long time, but he had a lot of responsibility at Iowa State. So that's a little different than I'm used to. But you talk about a kid who wants to learn and always inquisitive. He's very independent, which is something you have to be able to have as to be a great coach and accountable. You want something done, he gets it done. But I think he's come in a little more probably polished maybe at this point in 3 or 4 months. So I think his future is very high, and I've had great assistants. Every one of my assistants has been a home run, and they've gone on to do great things in golf. And I expect nothing different than for Ruben. I think Ruben's going to be a great head coach someday, as long as he stays, and I think he will, but stays passionate. And like we talked about earlier, if you want to be good at something, you want to be in the zone and you want to be successful, you have to have passion. And you also have to realize when that passion diminishes or goes away. Now, his passion is off the charts. He loves the pace of our program. He loves the intensity of our program. He'll see a lot more of it this spring, because we all know, as you know, springs are a lot more intense than the falls. And I think he's looking forward to it. But he's organized. He knows the game. He's really a good player too. And that's something I'm excited about him, is that he brings that knowledge of the game, which I think is very, very important for a coach to have. And he's not too far removed from playing professional golf, which is good. So I'm excited about Ruben, and I know he was in high demand, so we were happy to get him.
Yeah, he did a great job with him. I remember him as a player when he played at Iowa State. We played in several tournaments with them. But I also remember watching him as he was a brand new coach at Iowa State, and took him to dinner one evening and just asked him a lot of questions. And I realized, oh my gosh, I wasn't even close to being as far along as he is at his age. He's a long way down the road. Going to be a great coach. What would be your best piece of advice for a young coach? Let's say it could be Ruben, it could be anybody, just like one bit of advice you'd think that would make their learning curve a lot easier or help them down their path.
Wow. If somebody asked me that question, I'd have to get a little more background on them and where they're at in their career, what their aspirations are. Boy, I tell you what, I'd be honest with yourself. I'd be committed to the lifestyle. And I talked to a lot of coaches, young coaches, and if you really want to coach, and this is something that maybe I shouldn't say because I can't relate to it, because I came off the tour and went straight to a Division I head men's golf position in a Power Five conference. So I was lucky. I didn't have to back then. I just did. Number one, coaches could be head coaches right away. They didn't have to really, matriculate through an assistant's position. So, but nowadays, it seems like a lot of athletic directors and co colleges are inviting or hiring more assistant coaches. So if you want to be a head coach, jobs are so hard to get and so far and few between. Are you prepared to coach anywhere? Are you prepared to coach because you love to coach, or you're coaching because you want to go play at a certain or coach at a certain type of program or type of situation? I think if you're in it for the right reasons and you want to coach, you need to be honest with yourself and you be prepared to go where you need to go. And sometimes it may be a place you don't want to go, but it's part of your plan. It's part of the journey. And if that's the case, then if you can honestly admit to yourself, that's okay, I want to go to somewhere where I may not want to be, if that's the only option I have to coach, if you really want to do that, you're in it for the right reasons. But
Love it.
and I would say that to a young player too. Illinois is different than a lot of other schools, and a lot of other schools are different than some other schools. They all have different deals. So like this program, come here to get better. Come here to work now so you can play later on tour or play later in life in golf and stay in the game of golf. Then some schools, they have a different recruiting mentality. They when you come and there's different things going on, and it's play now and go to work later type of thing. So it's find out your situation, be honest with yourself what you want, and be able to want to go to where you need to go to accomplish those goals.
Whatever it takes to get there, absolutely.
Yes.
Any player that you've coached, because we're talking about coaching, but players can actually help coaches along their path. So, is there any coach or not any player that you coached through the years who really kind of changed your view or understanding of the game or got you thinking a little bit different about the game?
I learn a lot from all of them. They may not know it, I mean, but I do. I watch. I'm a very observant person. I watch other coaches all the time. I just watch, and things come to me holistically. And to answer your question, I think the player that I would probably identify in that realm or that question would be like Thomas Peters, because I think he was, and Chris DeForest might be along those lines, the physically at the time, physically so gifted, and the prototypical modern day player that the game had changed since I played on tour. So Thomas Peters comes to us in what, 2010, maybe 2010, and he's just a different player, a different whole build and speed and compression. And the game was more linear with him. You know, I was used to growing up in a non-linear game where the ball would curve and you know, a lot of strategy and course management. Well, here's the first player that I ever coached that I said, whoa, I'm gonna have to start maybe changing my view on things and bomb it, get it out there and wedge it. And distance was a big deal because he had such speed and such command of his golf swing that I think he's the first person I saw that had played for me, that hit it so good and so hard and so long that I saw the game changing, that I needed to change maybe the way I thought about it. And I think I have. I think I've grown, and I've converted my thoughts on how to play the game. I've grown with the game, with equipment, and with the growth of players and the advent of speed. And I think he was the first one that made me realize that.
You know, his very first tournament was the Fighting Illini at Olympia Fields, and he played with Taylor Gooch, who's also playing his first tournament. And I walked in their group that day, and Taylor and I both looked at each other about midway through the round, and we said, "This kid's different." We both knew he was going to be a player.
It's a different sound. It was something else. And that was the first, he was a freshman on the first time we went to the match play, the final eight, for a top five finish. It was at your place, I think, at Oklahoma State
It
that year.
was,
And
yep.
that's when I had Luke and Scott, and we went to the match play, got beat by Georgia, I remember. Henley, Swafford, and English guys, those guys beat us. But Thomas grew a lot that year, and he helped me understand the game was different. I needed to go differently. But also, I think him being here and learning maybe some art to the game that he hadn't learned, I know for a fact that was it helped him, that he chiseled and softened his game a little bit, so he could have a little more, he could vacillate back and forth and be a little more charismatic on the golf course with his golf, and a little more, you know, non-linear, if you will, and had some different shots and short game and distance instead of just being so linear. So I think it was a huge benefit for both of us. But of all the players I've had, I think he's the one that really opened my eyes to this new stuff.
Well, I definitely noticed him his freshman year. So, well, finally, if you were the commissioner of college golf, I mean, I put you in charge, you make all the decisions. What's one thing you would change that would improve our sport today?
Wow.
Sorry, it's a heavy question.
Well, that is a good question, and it kind of goes against the way I think about a lot of things. I'll be honest with you. I get asked these questions, and being a senior coach now, you know, people look up to you and they ask you questions and your opinions on things. And I have more opinions than I used to have, but it still goes against my instincts, because I'm always come from the thread of life that, you know what, give me the rules. And I'm going to take my attention and my desire and my energy, and I'm going to play within those rules, and I'm going to see how good I can be. I was never one that wanted to change the rules or if this could be different. I never looked for another reason how I could win, or man, this is not right. I never really tried not to complain about things. I tried not to say, well, this is not right, and we need to do that. Now I've grown that way a little more as the older I've gotten, but I never, to answer your question, Michael, I never. You know, I never had an opinion on a lot of things. It's just like I see both sides of things. I can see that. I can see this. I can make sense. But, and if I was a commissioner, I'd probably have a different view. But as a coach, the way I program myself, just tell me the rules and I'm going to figure out how to operate within these rules and do it. So that makes this question hard for me. But off the top of my head, I'd like to see maybe more tournaments, but 3-day events. I like 2-day events. I think they're productive in a lot of ways as a coach and players. Too many of them sometimes, I think, are too much. But the way these kids come back to campus more tired than when they left is not a good thing. And I think if we had maybe 9 3-day events instead of 24 days of competition, maybe give us 27 days, but make it 9 3-day events. I understand we may not be able to have golf courses that available, but just maybe a little more, maybe softness to the schedule where we could have a little more time to decompress at tournaments instead of being such a sprint. Although we do 2 days because we have to. Again, that back to my point though, that's the rules. I'm trying to figure out the best way to grow my team and to accumulate wins and losses and get us into the postseason and be better in May than we are in August. But I think if it was universally 9 3-day events, we'd figure out how to do the same way, but it'd be a little more tolerable for our health.
I definitely agree with that, but I have a mixture. I have some, actually I have three de tournaments where we go 36, 18, and then the rest of them are 18, 18, 18. But well, Mike, you've given me some good things to think about, some great perspective on college golf and coaching and the way you coach. And you kind of, you actually showed me a little bit more about why you're so successful. I appreciate you spending the time with me here today. And I know a lot of people are going to enjoy this interview.
Well, like I said at the start, buddy, I have a lot of respect for you. You know, me, you, and Jay went into the Coaches Hall of Fame together, and I tell Jay that when I see him one time, and we start to if we reminisce, and that's one of the highlights of my career is obviously being recognized that way. But to go in with you guys, two coaches that I really respect and my era, if you will, and you guys are national champions, and you've done it the right way, and anytime you call me, Michael, I'm there for you. You know that.
Well, I definitely appreciate that. And I probably won't see you much this spring. I hope to see you at La Costa in late May. How about that?
Sounds like a plan.
All right, Mike. Thanks again. I appreciate you coming on today.
All right, man. We'll talk to you.